Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
When I pull up to the parking lot, it's time to level up. Dial in, showing out for your team. Listen up, get you some. I stand the fan to give you what you need. Fan fuel, game time. Turn up the intensity. Team colors bleeding now. 5 hour energy. For a limited time, get the fan fuel flavor at 5hourenergy.com.
Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
We coming to eighth time. Let's get to work in, man. Let's go.
Great day, great day. Oh, give me some juice, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Good Monday morning, everybody. Sports Radio 610, it's good to be with you. Sean Bajani and Seth Payne. Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast, who will be back, I would presume, Seth, tomorrow morning.
As long as he didn't get beat up in Pittsburgh.
Oh man, I did not know that's where he went.
He was at the Steelers game. Yeah,
I was gonna say.
I was dialed in on the Steelers game yesterday, so I could share the experience with him.
I was too. I was dialed in to everything NFL yesterday, especially so. It's getting late, and these games are getting bigger. They mean more. They're getting more exciting, and well. You know, at least for the Kansas City Chiefs, it's like more of the same. This is just incredible what they have done and what they are doing over the course of the last month and change.
It's the, how many straight one possession games is it now that they've had? It's a record 15th straight one possession game, which extends the longest streak in NFL history. They won it with the fourth field goal kicker they've used this year, with a doinker. Right off the goalposts, and yeah, there you have it. That's the one, like a lot of these one possession games that the Chiefs keep winning. I'm like, yeah, well, I mean, they're like the Astros. They get into crunch time, and they have so much experience, and Pat Mahomes is so good in the clutch that there you go. And yet, some of those, it just seems like the football gods are just the preordaining this. The fact that you've got various field goal clickers doinking it in, and it just feels like we're all screwed.
It does. You know, when the kicker's doing that sort of thing, and that's the fate, and, you know, listening to Mike Tirico last night on the call, where, you know, they're showing the replay over and over again as they're kind of doing the game recap, and he's just constantly like, you know that goalpost, it's about as wide as a dollar bill. Like, that's how close it was. this thing could have gone a lot of different ways. And he described it about three different ways to Sunday. And I'm just like, you know, that's just it. But people are going to gloss over a little bit. Like, okay, it came down to a 31-yard chip shot doinker for their ninth straight AFC West title. But it was also the drive before where, hey, Pat Mahomes had to get him down there again. And give them the opportunity. And so that's the part where, as much as people are going to say and have been saying already about this Kansas City Chiefs team, like, well, they look very gettable, and we're going to talk about that later, just how gettable maybe they are, particularly for a Texans team that's going to face them here in a couple of weeks. That's the respect you have to continue to give them, though. As many mistakes as they've made along the way, as many close games as they've played in where maybe you feel like they shouldn't have been so close, they're still winning and putting themselves in position. And that, to me, is the mark of a very dangerous team again.
Well, and I think if you watch Pat Mahomes in that game, he was under pressure all day long. Like, I mean, that's the frustrating thing about the Chiefs is you can look at the Chiefs and make any number of excuses for your own team. Mm-hmm. You know, we've done it with CJ all year long where you say, well, look, CJ's numbers are pretty comparable to Pat Mahomes in a lot of ways. CJ's thrown fewer interceptions, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same thing we saw with Brady for all those years in with the Patriots. It's, all right, the fourth quarter is a different game. It's just that it's like a completely new football game almost like if at the end of the third quarter, everybody could go in and watch film for like 6 hours, figure out what happened in the first three quarters, and then go out and act on it. the Patriots do that, or excuse me, the Chiefs do that just as the Patriots in it on the fly. Yeah. And it, like, they might as well have had an 8-hour film session in the locker room, because yeah. they figured you out and they know what they can and can't do. And Mahomes was under as much pressure as he's been all season. He got rid of the ball the second fastest he has all year. And it just, they figured it out. That second game that you play in the fourth quarter, you're up against a much tougher opponent, because they've learned yeah. more than you, and they're more capable than you.
I was laughing at you just a second ago from the Freudian slip of the New England Patriots, because, well, yeah. that was like the creme de la creme for, you know, two decades plus with Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. And of course, like, they're always going to be the team that you reference for doing great things and doing the little things. And now that has gone away and retired, it is Pat Mahomes and Andy Reid and the Kansas City Chiefs to point to.
And I wasn't watching closely enough. Do you know what Hopkins' injury was, and is it considered serious?
I do not, actually. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I meant to check on that this morning.
We're all ignorant this morning, everybody. this is where you came for your up to date DeAndre Hopkins injury news. You're SOL, everybody.
Yeah, we'll find something. But I would presume, like, anything with some sort of finality, we're not going to know until a little bit later on this afternoon. You know how these yeah. things kind of go with the injuries. But that was just one of the things. And the last thing, you know, that's what I went to bed to last night, was another Kansas City Chiefs dramatic win. But it was just an incredible week, Seth, in the world of sports. I mean, you think about just, hell, not even the weekend, just the last 24 hours. Just another wild and crazy slate of games in the NFL. The Chiefs putting the nightcap on it last night. But you had Baseball Hall of Fame announcements, with Dick Allen and Dave Parker getting announced by the ERA committee that they're going to be in Cooperstown later on this summer. And a historical hot stove coming to a head with Juan Soto in this just ridiculous contract that he's signing with the New York Mets come down last night.
Yeah, Mets. Yeah, just spend it, Mets.
Unbelievable.
I'm cool with the Mets spending. I'm cool with for different reasons than I'm cool with the Angels spending. The Angels, it always feels like, all right, well, we'll see what you do with this after you squandered the best baseball player of a generation. They've had two generational talents in a row and done nothing with them. The Mets, it doesn't concern us as much. Right?
No, it doesn't.
Like, you just keep it out of this league and we're okay. I don't have to worry about it. We'll see him, we'll see him once a year at least, but that's about it.
But look, Patrick Creighton is an Astros guy, an Astros yeah. fan. I could say that. However, his allegiance hails from New York, and so
he's a Mets guy.
He's okay. Also a damn Mets guy, so I'm gonna have yeah. to live with that crap.
I know? Respect Mets fans. Mets fans have taken it on, like, they know what they've done to themselves. Yeah, like, yeah, I appreciate anybody who just chooses to buck the Yankees and, you know, not take the easy choice if you grow up in the New York area.
But you know what? This is just another example of, like, up against it and financially irresponsible as they were, this organization, just like 2 years ago when they bought everybody and they had yeah. Scherzer and they had Verlander and they went on this wild spending spree that offseason to only start the year off like absolutely horrible, one of the worst teams in baseball, to tear it down to here we are again. They give the richest contract in pro sports history out to Juan Soto, 15 years. God bless America. $785 million with escalators, Seth, that could make it an $800 million contract.
I think the biggest thing, and I don't want to get into a big salary cap or luxury tax conversation. It's at 6:08 a.m. on a Monday. But I mean, it's the biggest problem with baseball compared to football is that football, hey, look, okay, the Detroit Lions are the darlings of the league. The Kansas City Chiefs yeah. are the best team. They have been the best team for going on a decade. And the salary cap helps in that regard. Like, mm-hmm. It's undeniable. And baseball is probably never going to get it. But look, Stephen Cohen is a multi-billionaire who loves to collect nice things, whether it be art or baseball players. And it just doesn't matter how much money he spends. If he's willing to spend the money, then he can continually do all that. Whereas, okay, Jim Crane is going to be, he's not as rich as Stephen Cohen. If he wants to have a more competitive baseball team, he has to go out and work harder at his core business.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to accuse him of not working hard enough. I'm sure he works plenty hard at his core business.
He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. If you'd like to be a part of the show this morning, hit us up, 713-572-4610, 572-4610. You can call or text the 5-Hour Energy fan line. 5-Hour Energy, the official energy shot of Sports Radio 610. It is a Texans game week. We've got a short show. This is what drives me crazy. I just told you about great weekends, great sports weekends like this is Monday morning. You come in and you only have a couple hours to try to sift through as much as possible. And you have to sit on a lot of these thoughts, a lot of the things that excite you. But this is a big day for the Houston Texans. It's a big week because there's no more off days. It's boom. You got to this point. You had the bye week and maybe you tried to figure some things out. We're going to hear from head coach D'Amico Ryans later on today. He'll address the media at 12:15 about the upcoming Miami game, which, look, they're coming off of a victory yesterday over the New York Jets and Aaron Rodgers. We'll talk a little bit about that one, Seth, but I'm kind of interested in hearing what D'Amico has to say today and what kind of tone this press conference is, because I feel like coming off of that Aziz Alshire debacle and, you know, everything that was this past week that we've discussed, and I'm sure we'll continue to do so, this press conference today can kind of set the tone for the week and exactly who this Texans team over the course of the next month plus is going to try to be who they need to be.
Right, and I would say it seems almost the last couple of weeks leading into the bye, I hate to body language read too much because you just, it's fraught with peril. You know, you just read your own biases into it. And yet it did feel to me like in press conferences and by their play on the field that the Texans were running on fumes in a lot of ways. I don't want to make excuses for the Titans game or anything else, but it just, the late bye week, for the first time in my life watching and playing in the NFL, I really cared about the bye week this year because, man, having a late bye week really seems to have started to take its toll versus the Texans those last couple weeks. So, for one, you know how distance runners will taper off a couple weeks leading into a big race? I feel like, okay, this bye week could be kind of like tapering off. I treated it like that myself, Sean. I upped my carb intake. I tried to stay off my feet.
Yeah.
You try to just top off the energy reserves for what's going to be an endurance event. It's come Sunday, you've got 11 days to play 3 football games versus 3 very competitive football teams, 2 of which are the best in the league, but 3 very competitive football teams. Yeah, I hope we get a re-enlivened and reinvigorated Texans team that they're still going to have all the same problems they had going into it.
Yeah.
But I need juice, man. I need juice.
Yeah.
Alshire's incident may ultimately, in a lot of ways, have kind of helped in a couple of regards. One, maybe it's something to rally around and focus on.
Yes.
You know, like free Aziz and all that. But two, it did shift all the attention away from Bobby Slowick and from all these other things that we've been wringing our hands out over for the last few weeks.
Yeah, it shifted the attention, but we're going to go right back to that if, in fact, come Sunday afternoon at NRG, there's not at least somewhat of a discernible difference in terms of what we're watching from this Houston Texans team offensively and defensively, for that matter, on the field against the Miami Dolphins. We'll talk about that when we return. 713-572-4610. If you want to be a part of the show, you can hit us up on Twitter as well. Follow Seth at Seth C. Payne on Twitter, at Sean Bajani for myself. What do we have to fear from the Miami Dolphins? That and more next at Sports Radio 610.
It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
In for Sean Pendergast this morning, I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne. Got you till 8 o'clock this morning before we turn things over to Texans Radio. They'll get you set for a big game week coming up. course, week 15, Texans and Dolphins at NRG. The Dolphins, Seth, coming off of a victory yesterday against Aaron Rodgers and the New York Jets, 32-26. That was an overtime game. And, well, at least for some, who would have thunk it, right? The Fins looked literally dead in the water at a couple of different points yesterday. And I saw this on Twitter from Cody Stutes. And it drove me crazy immediately because I was checking into that game. Because, of course, you know, Texans play the Fins this upcoming weekend. And before we get into, you know, what kind of concerns you and intrigues you really about this game, Texans and Dolphins, I saw this tweet. And this was at 2:13 yesterday afternoon. And I think this is probably around the time of the game where the Fins at the time were losing 26-23 in the fourth quarter. This is a tweet from Cody Stutes. Quote, the Dolphins could be close to opening the can of quit on the season if they lose to the Jets. It would be nice to have a downtrodden Dolphins team come to NRG Stadium next week for that game. And I just saw downtrodden. And I saw it like there's plenty of football left to be played at the time. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, I hate this mentality. It drives me freaking crazy. For people that have this mentality, here's where my mind went. You're telling me like the Jets right now aren't a downtrodden team? They're playing in a competitive game against a team that is fighting for their playoff lives as we speak at the time during that game. And it's the NFL and they've got the quarterback. And, you know, did you not just watch or are you watching the Panthers and Eagles right now? I mean, the Eagles were 14 points favorites yesterday. And they went down to the final possession and damn near lost. We could get to that one a little bit later on. That could have cost some individual in Kentucky a lot of money, but didn't. But that's just where my mind went. It's the NFL. You can't count anybody out. It doesn't matter what your record is. At this stage of the season still, especially for the Dolphins, they've got a lot to play for.
Well, even if the Dolphins had lost yesterday, as it stands right now, I think they still would have been the second team out of the playoffs. So, and they would have been one game behind the Colts still. So right now they're tied with the Colts at 6-7, but the Colts have the whatever tiebreaker it would be.
Yeah.
So yeah, for one, just strictly on the standing side of things, it's not like the Dolphins would be out of it. I think the other thing is yes, it's the NFL, and we have already known, like, nobody's ever going to just count a team out in any given Sunday just because they're out of the playoffs. But B, they'd be in the playoffs, and the difference with the Dolphins this year has been so stark between Tua and not Tua. They've been a horrendous offense without Tua Tagovailoa. In a lot of regards, they've been like a top five offense when they do have Tua Tagovailoa.
Not shocking. So,
yeah, for the players that might let go of the rope or what have you. It's different when you know you've got your quarterback. If you're out there and you're playing with Davis Mills or you're playing with just some guy that you know is not the guy for the future, sure, perhaps maybe then there's a little bit more the distraughtness or what have you.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have thought, oh, okay, the Dolphins, if they had lost this game, I wouldn't have thought, oh, okay, well, this will be an easy one coming in. We've learned this from the Texans. You have zero hope based on a team being out of the playoffs. The Titans' playoff percentage probability and everything had nothing to do with the Texans losing that game.
Right. Boy, Davis Mills catching a stray at 6:25 this morning.
I'm sorry, Davis Mills. It is what it is. Dang it.
Love it. So what do we have to fear from the Miami Dolphins? I know you've got a couple of thoughts on this, Seth, but here's where I'm at right now. In terms of this Dolphins team, I'm looking at a squad that could be coming into NRG with some renewed confidence this upcoming weekend. And the reason is, you are what you've done here lately. That's the momentum you're trying to build and carry over. And look, this was their first overtime game as an organization in almost 5 years. Now, the guys playing for the Dolphins right now don't give a rip about that. They don't care. That's just a little interesting stat nugget for us. But when you're coming off of a 32-26 victory, no matter who it is against, the fact that you did it in the fashion you did in overtime, one possession, 8 plays, 70 yards, and you go down and you win a football game with that said quarterback in Tua Tagovailoa, that's a huge boost. I think, for a team that is, again, literally fighting for their playoff lives.
Yeah, I think if you look at the way they're constructed, the reason that the Dolphins make me really nervous is that, look, they have Tyreek Hill, they have Jaylen Waddle, mm-hmm. they haven't had incredible seasons or anything. Just go back to everything we said about with Tua. But Jonnu Smith, the tight end who ended up winning the game-sealing touchdown in overtime, he's basically got the same receiving numbers as both Tyreek Hill and Jaylen Waddle. They're all within 100 yards of each other on total receiving. They've all got between 11 and 13 yards per catch. Jonnu Smith has 5 touchdowns. Tyreek Hill has 5 touchdowns. But the Jonnu Smith factor in his ability, like he did on that final touchdown,
yeah.
to catch stuff underneath and across the middle because everybody's fixated on Jaylen Waddle and Tyreek Hill. That's a big concern for the Texans when you're down Azeez Alshire, when you've had to shuffle up your safeties. It was a safety Man. That got beat by Jonnu Smith on that final play.
Yeah.
And that's where it just the Texans have struggled with that kind of stuff all year long defensively, even though they've been, you know, very good defensively. I'm extra concerned about it this week. That it's when Tua can get rid of the ball as quickly as he does, and when he does have that option to throw to a tight end, to throw to a running back, that's what the Texans, I think, are really susceptible to right now. So they've really just got to be nails everywhere else.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to as well with Devon Achane. You know, 6 catches, 45 yards yesterday. Tua getting rid of the football, you know, quickly. He threw it 47 times yesterday. And, you know, look, Achane didn't have a very good game rushing the ball. But when you're able to just kind of get him in space, that's what we try to talk about a lot around here with Joe Mixon. And what we'd like to see the Texans do a little bit more is instead of just being so hell-bent on running the football with the guy, get him out into space, throw him the ball a little bit. Now that you don't have Azeez Alshire, do you worry about that from a defensive perspective, you know, from the Texans, like where, okay, look, yeah, you've got Tyreek Hill and you've got Jaylen Waddle, you got Jonnu Smith, all these guys, weapons as pass catchers. You also have Achane as well.
Yeah, right. And I think that's where the one big thing that the Texans are lagging on defensively that's maybe the biggest disappointment for me is that they're not tackling well. And too many of the big plays are not just because of coverage gaffes, but because of poor tackling. Mm. And that's exactly where the Dolphins can get you, is getting rid of the ball quickly and then a guy having some space to run, getting yardage after the catch. You've got to worry about that from all those guys, but especially, obviously, Tyreek Hill and Jaylen Waddle. So without Azeez Alshire, I think what I really get nervous about is the potential snowball effect. If a team's out there and they're running tempo against you, or they're just peppering you with so many pass attempts, you got to keep everybody on the right page and together. And then especially with the RPO game, that puts a lot of stress on linebackers. That takes a real heady linebacker that can get the reads, understand whether they're supposed to be in coverage or coming up and playing the run. And that's really hard to do. Christian Harris coming back could help in a lot of regards, but I'm still nervous about just having the guy that's the signal caller being in complete and total control. And if that has to be Neville Hewitt or if it has to be Henry Toa, that part just, it's not the same as obviously having Azeez Alshire.
It was noticeable to me when Alshire missed those 3 weeks earlier this season, week 7 through 9. Texans were 1-2 during that stretch. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that Colts win was bookended by the loss to the Packers, close game, and a loss to the Jets. And, you know, look, Neville Hewitt, Jake Hansen, there is reason for optimism, at least from my perspective, that now that you're having to go through this other stretch towards the end of the season without your linebacker, another leader on the field in Alshire, I got some confidence in that. You know what, Hansen and Hewitt and Henry Toa, who's playing better ball now, they can step in and fill that void. But this is the biggest stretch of the season. This is what you've had circled on your schedule all year long. When Alshire came back, Seth, one of the biggest differences that I thought anybody could tell if you watch this team with regularity is pre-snap, being in position, the communication, comfortability that guys have when both Jimmy Ward and Azeez Al-Shaair are on the football field together. It's just a different beast for the Texans defensively.
Yeah, and I think that maybe one of the things you're going to see from the more from the Texans is maybe a more aggressive play calling. And D'Amico's done that this year. He's been a lot more aggressive than I thought he would be.
Yeah.
When you have Kamari Lassiter and Derek Stingley, it's a lot easier to do that. They take care of a lot of the issues on the backside. So I think that, I mean, if you look at the linebackers right now, they've got athletes all over the place, especially if Christian Harris comes back. And you add Devin White into the mix, Devin White's been a lot of what he's been his entire career. My gosh, he is fast. He can be an impact player, but you can't quite trust him to be in the right spot all the time. And I think D'Amico is going to look at that and think, all right, well, it is what it is. I don't know if I can trust these guys to sit back and play base defense and just go through their reads and always be in the right spot. So we're just going to blitz the crap out of teams.
Yeah.
And it's boom or bust, but if we can trust the cornerbacks to hold up long enough, and if we can trust the blitz and the pass rush to get there, we could make some really big high impact plays with these athletes we've got.
Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast this morning. You know, looking at the other side of the ball, because that's where a lot of the attention, I think, is naturally going to go this week going into this game against the Dolphins, who will be at NRG on Sunday, is from the Texans' offensive standpoint. Okay, you're coming off of this bye week. There were some things that clearly needed to be addressed, and you've had the time to do so now. You can put it into practice this week on the practice field. Are there one to three things maybe that you had in your mind that you felt like the Texans absolutely could? We know they needed to address a lot, but actually could address, and that we might be able to evidently see on Sunday that's evidence of change.
I think the biggest thing that I'd like to see is that maybe they figured out a couple things in the run game. And the one big glaring difference in the Texans and how they're running the football really has been, okay, how physical is the defensive line they're facing? Because I think the Texans offensive line has done a better job on the mental side of things. They look like they actually know who they're supposed to be blocking. That's a big step forward for both Pop Warner football teams and the Houston Texans is, hey, know who you're supposed to block. So good job there. But it's not like they're all of a sudden road graders and that they can just drive guys off the ball. So it really comes down to, all right, picking and choosing who are you gonna pick on? Who's the weak link on the opposing defensive line, and how can you get that guy exploited? Because I think Laremy Tunsil does a great job in the run game versus finesse players.
Yeah.
He doesn't do so hot versus big physical strapping dudes. And that's where you got to single out and figure. And some of this comes back on C.J. Stroud on understanding and conducting, hey, where are we attacking in the run game? How can I check the play at the line of scrimmage, and when should I, based on what I'm seeing? I just hope I see a smoother operation in that regard. And I pick and choose your battles and figure out who you can actually physically handle on any given Sunday.
Yeah. We'll get to more of the Texans coming up a little bit later on in the show. We've got you till 8 o'clock this morning. Up next, though, after a wild and very busy weekend in sports, we'll get you caught up with it all in headlines. It's next. Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast, along with Seth Payne at Sports Radio 610. Keep it here.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
All right, time for headlines. It's Payne and Pendergast in for Sean Pendergast. I'm Sean Bajani. We'll start with a little local flavor first. The Rockets, Seth, last night in action against the LA Clippers, and won 117-106. It was good for them to get off a little two-game skid and get back on the winning track, as they'd been doing a lot of here recently to start the season. Now 16-8. The Rockets rolling with no Tari Eason last night, who, if you remember, against the Sacramento Kings the other night, that was the game in which both Ime Udoka and Alperen Şengün were ejected in the fourth quarter. I don't know that we'd seen Ime that heated before, and the cameras were glued on those guys while Tari Eason was going at it with a fan, though luckily for the fan and really for Eason and the Rockets, not able to make it to the fan. had to be held back from charging into the stands and going after him. I just got a number of texts this morning. Hey, by the way, where's Tari Eason? Did he actually go into the stands and punch a guy like Vernon Maxwell? No, he didn't. Yeah. Thankfully, he did not.
We didn't. There was no malice at the whatever they're called, the stadium there these days. Yeah,
that was
the Clippers. By the way, the Clippers had won 9 out of 10 at home coming into this game. And I thought they shot as well as they ever have. Their 48% shooting on the night, and Udoka kind of. I thought it was a really good job early in the third quarter of reining everything back in where. They came out sloppy. Udoka calls an angry timeout, and then they only commit one more turnover the rest of the game after they started off super sloppy and were coughing the ball up at the beginning of the second half. But after their last game, where there was one of their worst shooting performances of the year, this team that hangs its hat on their defense came out, and they shot the lights out.
They did, and they killed it on the boards last night. Massive advantage, 50-37 on the boards. And you mentioned the shooting. Nearly 49% from the field. They hit 15 of their 41 threes last night. Jalen Green, he was on, especially early. 31 points, that was a team high. The Rockets put 6 players in double digits, all 5 of the starters. Amen Thompson got the start last night. Played the most minutes out of anybody. 39 minutes for Amen. That dude is so freaking awesome and fun to watch. He finished with 22 points and 8 boards. A couple of double-doubles for Jabari Smith and Alperen Şengün. The Rockets will be back in action on Wednesday when they take on Golden State. That'll be a little bit of a rematch. Not sure. We'll have to keep an eye out to see if Steph Curry, Draymond Green are going to be playing in that game. They did not play this past week when the Rockets failed to take care of business without those two guys. One of their two losses this past week, one to Golden State and one to Sacramento. We'll see if the Rockets, Seth, can get back on track on Wednesday. How about this? I don't know how you're feeling about the first ever 12-team college football playoff, but it's set. The first round is ready to roll after it was announced yesterday. You got undefeated Oregon earning the number one overall seed. No surprise there in the first 12-team college football playoff. And you've got Georgia, Boise State, Arizona State rounding out your top four seeds with first round buys. What'd you think of the committee selections?
I'm cool with them all. I don't generally get all that angry about college football playoff committee seedings, especially when there's 12 teams. I guess my scrappy underdog story is Georgia, I suppose. The way they fought their way back this season from skepticism and whatnot. But like I say that tongue in cheek, obviously. And yet, like Gunnar Stockton.
Oh my gosh, what a game!
I mean, Gunnar Stockton took one of the. That was one of the most vicious hits I've ever seen.
Yes,
I don't know if I've ever seen a person go from upright to horizontal that quickly.
He
like
literally,
it skipped the frame. It was just he was standing up and then all of a sudden he was on the ground.
Yeah,
to get a first down in the red zone.
It was almost one of those situations. Great work by the camera guys, you know, on that broadcast because, I mean, Gunnar Stockton is making a beeline for the end zone, and it's almost like, you know, in baseball when a ball is hit, it's usually a Fox broadcast because those camera guys suck. And, you know, there's a high fly ball, and it's usually on Joe Buck call. He thinks it's a home run, and it's not a home run. And, you know, the camera just pans real quick to the stands and then back to the outfielder who makes the easy catch. It was, boy, you had to be on your game to stop the camera when Gunnar Stockton literally got stuck in his tracks and bent backwards. Helmet flies off. Dude gets right up, puts his helmet on, thinks he's going to stay in the game, gets ready for the next play. It's like, no, big dog, you got to sit this one out. And it was, they said it during the broadcast, you know, it's like a movie script, you know, unraveling here. Beck, who was, you know, bounced out of the game earlier with dead arm, basically a shoulder injury, comes out there with his arm hanging. And everybody in the stadium knows all this guy can do is hand the ball off and they still score.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he should have slid, obviously, Gunnar Stockton. That's a safe way to do it, I suppose.
Oh, is it now?
yeah. That's what they all say. Is yeah. You should slide whenever you get to that point. Yeah.
He didn't need no stinking slide. How about this, man? Mets and Juan Soto. This was the story that was just huge coming down the pipe last night late. 15 years, $765 million to the New York Mets, Juan Soto. I think landing exactly where everybody thought he was going to land because, well, they've got more money than anybody else these days. It's the largest deal in pro sports history. Yes, including soccer.
My first reaction was, okay, good. It's not in the AL. This is going to be an interesting side story every now and then when you face the Mets. But then my second realization was, oh, yeah. Yankees fans are going to be miserable about that. And the first Yankees fan I sought out delivered about as well as any Yankees fan has ever delivered. This is an angry Yankees fan outside of Citi Field with a message for Juan Soto.
Yo, Juan Soto, listen up, man. This is your new f***ing home. This is your new home right here. Shut the f*** up and don't f***ing complain. Look at this s***hole. Look at this hole right across the street. Look at this dump. Road closed. You chose this piece of to be your home for the next 15 years because you're a money hungry you. You. Every Yankee fan should burn you jersey. You, Juan Soto. My you too, Scott Morris.
That is not Ben. That is not Nick Turturro.
Thanks, Ben. I sent that to Ben, and he got all those beeps in. Good job.
Yeah, hell of a job there.
That feels good. Yeah, give me $765 million guaranteed. Ooh. And you can call me a money grub all you want.
Exactly.
You can talk about how my workplace isn't as beautiful as apparently the Bronx is. I've been to Yankee Stadium. It's not like you're like, ooh, I want to set up camp. Can I just live in a tent right here outside the stadium? It's so beautiful. That Yankees Stadium, the new one and the old one, is perpetually one of the most overrated stadiums. So I don't get it.
It's it's kind of like maybe there's a little bit of Rocky flair here for Juan Soto. You know, it's like he's got the money, he's got the contract, he's got the status, all of the stuff, right? But hey, he's going to stick to his roots. You know, when he goes to work during the day, he's going to Queens, damn it. You know, he's going to be kind of slumming it. You know, it didn't have to be walking into marble floors and marble walls at the new Yankee Stadium. It's, I'll go play at this dump Citi Field, apparently, and be just fine because I get to go home with my $800 million.
If he just lives off his per diem, even after taxes up in New York, I calculated it out this morning, with a conservative investment growth strategy, he would likely be a billionaire in about 13 years. So that's his,
off of per diem.
If he just lives off the per diem, which is really big in baseball. They get nice per diems.
Yeah. We'll see. Good luck to him. By the way, the biggest thing for me contractually in this is there's reportedly no deferred money. So the New York Mets, while they're stuck paying Bobby Bonilla till I'm like 60 years old, will not be paying Juan Soto at that age, at least as of right now, unless they rework his deal at some point.
This is the biggest contract in pro sports history, including soccer.
Yeah,
just like anywhere in the world, nobody's ever gotten this much guaranteed.
Never. Money. Never. Yeah. Insane. And soccer would be the one. That's but like, yeah, but, you know, guys like David Beckham and stuff like that have gotten ridiculous deals over the years. No, this is $51 million average annual value, total monies included. Biggest deal in pro sports history. A quick nod and shout out to a couple of guys that predated us, Seth. Dave Parker and Dick Allen, selected by the Classic Baseball Era Committee. They'll be Hall of Famers and inducted next summer. And we'll find out if little H-Town flavor is going to go in as well. Billy Wagner up for election as well this year. Coming up next, we'll roll into the 7 o'clock hour. Are you ready to bury this situation, or is it really just beginning? That's next at Sports Radio 610.
It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
Good morning, everybody. 7 o'clock hour, Sports Radio 610. In for Sean Pendergast this morning. I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne. We've got you till 8 o'clock this morning before we turn things over to Texans Radio. In between now and then, if you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, 713-572-4610, 572-4610. You can text in the 5-Hour Energy fan line, 5-Hour Energy, the official energy shot of Sports Radio 610 and football super fans. We'll get to a little Texans here. I asked the question, are you ready to burn this situation? Or is it actually just beginning? I think both can be true, Seth, but that's why I'm a little bit intrigued about the DeMeco Ryans press conference coming up later today. He'll address the media at 12:15.
I'm guessing a lot of our listeners have gone through this too. You feel like, all right, yeah, I'm done with the Aziz Alshire stuff. That's enough. But then something comes across your social media timeline, or some idiot at the convenience store says something that annoys you, and you're right back in it. Right back in it. And I know myself. I'm going to be baited back into this at some point. The most encouraging thing, I think, after the initial fervor was that I've seen so many offensive players and former offensive players kind of come around, if not in defense of Aziz Alshire, at least to say, all right, let's back off a little bit and not be painting this guy like he's the most evil person who's walked the earth this century. Mm-hmm. So like Mark Schlereth, former offensive lineman, old school guy, but an offensive lineman. This is Mark Schlereth on Fox talking about how basically disingenuous he thinks some other former players and current players are being.
I feel like it's my responsibility to at least try to educate you from a player's perspective on how split seconds those are. But let me just say this. The thing that irritated me and has irritated me more than the general population that doesn't understand how hard that is and the dilemma you put the defensive players in is former players and current players not standing up and being honest. That's what bothers me because it's impossible.
And I think that's where I we've seen a lot of offensive players and quarterbacks. I mean, I think more take the slide rule on than they have any interest in painting out Aziz Alshire to be a monster. And I guess that's where I understand why Caserio was so adamant about that letter, because it might have felt to some people, and I know it felt to a lot of people, like Caserio was missing the point or trying to sidestep the issue.
Yeah.
I think the way that letter from the NFL read and the way it was framed, they basically did make it sound like he was just completely out of control and he didn't give a damn about anything or anybody. Frankly, I thought it painted him out to be like a headhunter, which even on that play itself, I didn't think if he had wanted to hit Trevor Lawrence in the head, he totally could have hit him in the head.
Yeah.
That part of it, I think that'll die down over time. I don't think come February or March, people around the league are going to be framing this like, oh yeah, Aziz Alshire is the new Vontaze Burfict or something like that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, because how far the Texans go and remain a part of the conversation could have a little bit to do with that. But in regards to that letter alone, the letter in large part, the way it read to me and the way that Caserio, I think, took it, it was much more about what happened after the hit. The hit's the one thing. It's just everything that transpired after. And if we're being real about it, we're not spending a week on this thing if it's just a hit. We're spending a week on it because it's the hit. Then there's two fights afterwards, and we're looking at a guy who, you know, came unhinged a little bit, but had an entire football team like trample him and go after him initially. And so that's really the whole thing. And it sparks, you know, the conversation. Well, it shouldn't, but it did, you know, about a guy's religious beliefs and political beliefs. And then it becomes personal for a lot of people. And that's where we went.
Yeah, and Evan Engram was fined this weekend for his, I think it was a $9,000 fine.
Whopping $9,000. You talk about per diems, huh?
yeah. Which, and like, that's where I feel like there's a bit of hypocrisy from the league in that they supposedly care about player safety regardless, and a hit in retribution is not any different than a hit on a quarterback at full speed, where Evan Engram, no matter what his motivation was or anything else like that, I mean, he flat out hit a guy from behind who was completely and 100% totally defenseless.
Yeah.
It was several seconds after the play. I do feel there's a little, if what you're actually concerned about is player safety, that's a pretty damn egregious violation. And if the melee afterwards was part of what you're finding Azeez Alshire for, I'm surprised that no other Jaguars are fined or treated harshly for that. That's where I just, it still feels to me like a whole lot of grandstanding by the league.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the fact that Trevor Lawrence is a quarterback, that's a bit, the guys who are literal headhunters who are actually getting suspended and fined for helmet-to-helmet contact or targeting the head, like, those hits are much, much worse in terms of the actual contact. The Neville Hewitt's hit last year that got him suspended was a helmet-to-helmet blow. That's the part where I get they have to protect their moneymakers, but don't try to paint Azeez Alshire out like he is Avantaze Perfect or any of these other guys that were notorious headhunters.
No, I agree with you. I mean, to me, if you're going to, you know, hand out punishments like the NFL didn't, by the way, it was like just over 11,000 for Evan Engram on the fine. But, you know, what about Jerrion Jones? I'm sure if you went and reviewed film, you'd find a couple of other Jacksonville Jaguar players, because it was on their sideline, that you could have found at fault for failing to extinguish, you know, the situation, or exacerbating things because of their actions. And if again, you're talking about player safety, if you're talking about the integrity of the league, if you're worried about all of those things and just moving on and getting back to playing football as quickly as you possibly can after a hit like that, then you have to be able to punish the guys that disallowed you from doing so. And there were far more many Jacksonville Jaguars that continued to fan the flames and overreact, or just react. I won't say overreact, because I get it about protecting your player, especially a quarterback. I just felt like the NFL again mishandled the situation, and now you have to deal with the consequences and move on.
Well, the other big thing about the aftermath was you had all these noble and virtuous souls standing up and saying, well, if Trevor Lawrence is going to miss four games because of a concussion, then Azeez Alshire should be out for four games.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they were almost reciting it like it was fact that he had been put on the IR, that Lawrence had been put on the IR because of the concussion.
Yeah.
Doug Peterson came out on Friday and flat out said, no, it was not the concussion that put him on IR. It was the shoulder, and that he had to have shoulder surgery. And a few people dialed it back. Some didn't bother addressing it at all. But Azeez Alshire didn't put Trevor Lawrence out for the season. I'm going to tell you another thing. This is something to monitor for a divisional opponent. I feel like Doug Peterson has maybe been one of the most level-headed guys in how he's responded to all this. This is a guy, you got to remember, Doug Peterson is a guy that played with Brett Favre. And I feel like Brett Favre, if he had gotten that hit, you know, back in the day where he wouldn't have had to enter the concussion protocol, he would have taken a shot of whiskey on the sideline and been back out there. It's just two different eras. But the thing with Trevor Lawrence is, it's every single year there are these minor injuries, and I include a separated shoulder in your non-throwing arm as a minor injury for a quarterback. Last year, CJ Stroud played through a separated shoulder all season long as a rookie. It's pain tolerance, and Trevor Lawrence has had so many minor injuries either affect his play or keep him out of games that I don't frankly think that he has the constitution of a good NFL quarterback, because that's part of the job in the NFL. As protected as quarterbacks are, they still take a lot of hits, and they're unprotected a large majority of the time, and they are injured all the time. So that, like, playing as badly as he did with a separated shoulder and his non-throwing arm,
yeah,
I honestly just don't get that. I don't, like, I, it doesn't, I, like, Sean, I know so many, like myself included, but I know so many defensive linemen that have played with separated shoulders. And then at the end of the season, sometimes the remedy is you just snip off your clavicle. If it's that badly separated, it's like you snip off the tip of the clavicle. It's like, so for a quarterback to go on IR because of that or to be playing poorly for it. I just have no sympathy for him. It just doesn't, it's not what tough NFL quarterbacks do.
Yeah, well, it's a different era. And you mentioned Doug Peterson.
But it's not a different era when it comes to stuff like that. The good quarterbacks are still playing through that stuff. I don't think Trevor Lawrence is a good quarterback specifically because of that.
Well, okay, yeah, I understand what you're saying now. You're right, on the surface. 100%. I'm talking about like the perception for a lot of people. That's a convenient excuse for a lot of people, and Jacksonville Jaguar fan as well. It's like, well, hey, look, our guy was hurt. Yeah, but it was his non-throwing shoulder. Okay. And then I had the question, you know, initially too. It's okay, if that hit doesn't happen, if the Jags go ahead and, you know, they get the brakes blown off of them or whatever, they lose that game. When do the Jags make the call of, you know, sitting Trevor Lawrence for the rest of the season anyway? Because... Right. Okay, you're going to miss, at least from what, every hit's different, but we've had multiple situations here over the last couple of years where the Texans have suffered concussions. They've missed not 1 week, but 2 weeks, usually. In some cases, I think it's been 3 weeks, depending on the player. Well, Trevor Lawrence, maybe he misses 2 weeks. You still got 2 weeks left to go in the season. They decided, well, the shoulder, let's go ahead and get the concussion out of the way and deal with the shoulder, and we'll press the reset button and hope for better next year.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty obvious. If Trevor Lawrence had continued to play the way he was playing, they probably would have done this with or without a head injury, because he was completely ineffective.
Yeah.
You saw that. Mac Jones came out and was way better, and now facing soft coverages because the Texans had a healthy lead, but still, he looked better even with his bad throws initially. Then some of the stuff Trevor Lawrence was doing. Trevor Lawrence was trying to make throws that he had no business trying to make, like throwing it at a double coverage into tight windows. He was lucky he only had one interception up to that point in the game. He easily could add three in the first half alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they probably, there's a good chance they would have shut him down. I know a lot of the criticism has been, why was he out there anyway looking as bad as he did? Nobody else was watching that game outside of Jacksonville or Houston.
Yeah.
Because why bother? Like you look at the coverage map of the markets that had that game, and it was pretty much Houston and Jacksonville and not many others.
Well, unfortunately, it's been that case. Yeah, AFC South showdowns in recent years. Well,
oh, yeah. No, they're relatively mute affairs. You got three. That's, man, I got jealous watching the Steelers and the Browns yesterday because it made me miss the old AFC Central.
Oh.
Like, oh, yeah. Man. Yeah, we used to be a part of the AFC Central, you know, like back when it was the Oilers, and it just, you had all these. And then even when the Jaguars were added to the mix, they were very good at the beginning. Like, well, it was still the AFC Central. The Jaguars were a team to be contended with. And now, not so much.
Real quick, you mentioned Doug Peterson. I'm sure you saw his comments responding to D'Amico's, you know, stance on the hit last week. I was impressed immediately by Peterson's, you know, attitude and kind of level of emotion. You said, you know, I think level-headed was the term that you used.
Yeah.
You said, quote, I would say that if it happened to their quarterback, I think the reaction would have been the same, quite frankly. But again, look, this was 3 days ago, and we're on to Tennessee, obviously, and focused on that. But I do think the reaction is a natural thing for any player, any team to feel. That's 3 days after the fact, those comments.
Yeah.
They were very similar to his reaction minutes after the game had concluded. Like, the guy, when I think a lot of Jacksonville fans are, you know, expecting to hear the same thing from Doug Peterson from their behalf that we heard from D'Amico Ryans on the Texans' behalf, they didn't get. And I think that's what kind of miffed a lot of Jacksonville Jaguar, you know, sports talk show hosts and fans. It's like, you know, what are we doing here? Like, where's the reaction here? Where's the proper response? Like, everybody's high and, you know, very high emotion after the hit, after the game. And you have Doug Peterson very calm, level-headed, and, you know, saying, as a former quarterback himself, yeah, I kind of get it. You know, it's the shoe was on the other foot, and that's not what they were ready to hear.
It's one, I will say that's one thing that D'Amico's done a couple times this year with Alshire, where I feel, you know, the couple things that Caserio and D'Amico did in their defense of Alshire that didn't quite ring true. And I think with D'Amico twice now with Alshire, he's criticized the other team's sideline for the way they were handling things or anything.
Yeah.
But Aziz Alshire is the guy that finds himself in the middle of that. Because after the Bears game, D'Amico criticized the sideline management of non-uniformed personnel. And likewise, he criticized the Jaguars after. If there was no response from any Jaguars player, Jaguars fans would have been irate. We've done this ourselves. It was in the Green Bay game when CJ was getting roughed up on the sideline and there was nobody from the Texans over there to support him or bail him out or scrap it up. Last year when D'Amico got hit by that Broncos linebacker and four offensive linemen rushed up to help CJ, people very much noticed that Laremy Tunsil was just chilling at the line of scrimmage and not doing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the fans want to see a response like
that. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I get that part of it. And that's where I don't criticize Evan Engram for having the response he did. I criticize the league for not coming down harder on him and just fining him $9,000. If they're pointing to the melee, the league is pointing to the melee as one of the worst possible things that could have happened. All right, well, the way you guys write the rules and the way you enforce them is that Evan Engram is just as responsible for the melee as Aziz Alshire himself. That part of it bothers me.
He said,
In terms of other offensive players, I thought this one was interesting just because it's Equanimeous St. Brown and Amon-Ra St. Brown, brothers who are both wide receivers, current players in the league. Mm-hmm. This is Equanimeous St. Brown talking to his brother, Amon-Ra St. Brown, about how he feels about the Alshire hit.
What are your initial thoughts? One, it wasn't on purpose. I'm sure he's just playing hard. But usually they let up. You could slide earlier. I feel like
trying to get the extra yards.
Yeah, that's dangerous. Like, he's trying to stop you from getting the first down. You're trying to get the extra yards. Like, at that point, stay up. Like, some quarterbacks don't always slide. Like Josh Allen won't slide probably, you know? Sometimes sliding is more dangerous than not sliding, I feel like. If I was a quarterback, I would never slide, but, like, I'd slide hella early or not at all.
And then Amon-Ra St. Brown sounded a little bit more on the fence, except that also basically just he said, yeah, the sliding is – the quarterback takes – some responsibility when you slide. And I think that's the long-term implications of this is that I think they probably are going to tweak the slide rule somewhat or make it some kind of emphasis in the offseason. But I've actually been kind of pleasantly surprised by how many offensive players, both current and retired, have just come out and said, yeah, look, the targeting and everything, it all makes sense. We get it. But you got to acknowledge on some level and in some situations that it ain't easy.
Yeah.
And it's not always a matter of, okay, this guy's willfully trying to injure somebody who's unprotected. That's why it bothers me that the quarterback is being afforded so much extra attention in this one, because the wide receivers, when they get hit and targeted, they're genuinely defenseless. They have no say or control in the matter. They're catching the ball as it's thrown. They are stretched out and laid out. And a lot of times in a lot of those hits, you can see now that we've got a decade of kind of monitoring this stuff, there's times where you can tell, all right, the defensive back totally could have avoided that hit. Like,
sure.
We know.
Sure.
We used to say at the beginning of it all, we used to say, nah, there's no way. Now we know. But with the quarterback slides, I think it's just too much of a gray area still.
It's very gray. I mean, you know, the difference between a quarterback or just any ball carrier. Just look at it from this. If you already have the football and you're making football moves, you're concerned about one thing, avoiding a hit. Try not to get tackled. If you're concentrating, rather, as a pass catcher on trying to catch a football and avoid a hit and trying to make a football move, like all of these things going on in milliseconds time, that's what makes you more susceptible as a defenseless player in that regard. And so I think ultimately it's not that difficult to figure a remedy out, but it is very difficult when you're on the other side of the ball as a defender to make a split-second decision. These are things that are always going to be a part of the game as an operating in a gray area, because it's just about instinct and reaction, and you cannot predict nor expect what another player is seeing or say that they should be doing all of the time.
Right. When that quarterback is making that conscious or not conscious in the, you know, but he's making that decision to try to go for extra yardage and he's trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Absolutely.
Trying to get the first down, but also, you know, protect himself. I wish one thing Tom Brady would say, because Tom Brady has come out and basically said, yeah, it's really hard and the quarterback has to take responsibility.
Yeah.
I wish he would bring up that. I wish he would just say, this is why I kicked Ed Reed in the junk that time. You guys remember? Yes. Yeah, I slid, but I'm also like, I'm really trying to protect myself. And going in spikes high, for those of you that don't remember or are too young to have seen it, Tom Brady slid, but very much had his cleats in the air, and he connected with Ed Reed's groin back before Ed Reed was an awful Texan.
Ty Cobb that thing, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Ty Cobbed it. Just say that, Tom. Say just like, this is why I kicked Ed Reed in the nargs.
He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. We'll find out over the course of the week and the coming weeks just how much the Texans have decided to put this ordeal, the Azeez Al-Shaair ordeal, in the rearview mirror. Because I think there is an element where this team does kind of take on the villain role. I know that was very personal to Azeez, but I think the Texans can kind of accept that sort of a role from a football perspective as well. It'll be interesting to see what kind of nasty, because I go back to the conversation you and I had last year around this time where it was in and around the Denzel Perryman, you know, hit where he suffered punishment by the NFL. And that was a guy when the Texans brought him in where I was like, hey, you know what? Yeah, they got themselves a little thumper. They got themselves a little bit of nasty. Now let's see it put into action. Well, they did. And you see it kind of 2.0 this year. I wanted the Texans, and I think DeMeco wanted his defense to be that team with that moniker, not necessarily dirty by any stretch, at least one that's going to, you know, cost your team games and players games, but instill a little bit of fear and trepidation into the opposition.
Yeah. Like, he wants the opponent to feel it the next day.
Yeah.
And if you look at a team that the Texans are kind of on the same trajectory as you would hope, it's the Detroit Lions. You know, Dan Campbell was hired 2 years before DeMeco Ryans was, but the Lions defense is getting kind of a reputation, Brian Branch specifically, but the Lions are kind of getting a reputation as a team that, man, they're playing to the echo of the whistle, they're tough, they're physical, and I think by and large defenses like that are embraced by more NFL fans than are denigrated.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be the heated, whichever particular offense is getting the brunt of it, those teams are going to feel like, ah, those guys are monsters over there, or that Texans defense or that Lions defense. By and large, people like that. I think most NFL fans are like, yeah, you want to believe you're tough, you know, and you're like, yeah, they're soft now.
Yeah.
A lot of that just comes down to, all right, but are you also good? Don't just be don't be a dirty team, or don't be a team that's like playing right up, pushing up against the envelope, but you're also not good. Be a good football team, and then you get the rubber stamp of approval from most people.
See how good this Texans football team turns out to be coming out of the bye week, week 14. They'll be put to the test this weekend. The Dolphins got the job done yesterday over the Jets, 32-26 in a victory there. This Dolphins game looks a hell of a lot different now, coming up this Sunday, Seth, than it did, you know, 6 weeks ago. And this is what it looked like preseason. You knew this was the start of a gauntlet where you had Miami, you had Kansas City, and you had the Ravens on Christmas Day, and this gauntlet of three games in 11 or 12 days, whatever it is, like, here we go. This is going to be incredibly difficult. Is this team equipped to do this? Is this team talented enough and well coached enough to get through this gauntlet that you wouldn't maybe necessarily bat an eye at if it was the Chiefs doing it, or the Ravens doing it, or the Bengals doing it?
If we compared to how I felt about it at the beginning of the season, they're not nearly as equipped as I thought they would have been. The Dolphins game, first and foremost, you know, to tee off the festivities, Look, the Texans are favored in this game, and which I don't know if that's a surprise to people or not, but they're about a 2.5-point favorite, as it should be at home.
Home points, yeah.
Yeah, and they're a bit, like, the Dolphins are better with Tua, much, much better with Tua than they are without. But they're kind of average in a lot of regards. They look a lot like the Houston Texans. I think that the Dolphins game doesn't worry me anymore right now than it probably did at the beginning of the season, just because neither team is as good as the best possible version of it. So I feel good about that part of it. You get into the Chiefs and then the Ravens, and I mean, the Chiefs have played 15 consecutive one-score games.
Mm-hmm.
They keep winning them.
Yeah.
They have the lowest point differential ever for a 12-1 football team, or at least the lowest in many, many, many decades.
Wow.
That's the part where you look at it and you think, okay, well, the Chiefs play every team to just one possession. At the beginning of the season, I would have thought, okay, that's the Texans' dojo. They do really well in these one-score games. Now, not so much. I don't feel that same way. So I don't worry that the Texans are going to get bludgeoned by the Chiefs, but I have very, very little faith that if it comes down to the fourth quarter and one possession, that the Texans are going to be the first team that's able to undo the Chiefs, because they've just been too good in these situations.
Those are all great points. I think the Texans are good enough to where they could at least, you know, be in position to upset a Kansas City Chiefs team this year. Like, I've been thinking about this for weeks now. This is after last night's game, their win against the Chargers on a 31-yard field goal, doink, off of the left upright. This is their fourth game in their last five that has been decided by 3 points or fewer, and their fifth game in their last seven that has been decided by 6 points or fewer. All that the recency is the big one for me, because 15, I mean, that goes back to last year, and it's been a little bit, but
well, it goes to, and some of there's a, like, it goes back a long ways, and there's some luck involved in that too. If the Bills don't miss a field goal in the playoffs to tie it, you know, like, what exactly happens? It's just it takes a little bit of luck to go on runs.
You're
like
right
this.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that was a point that I was gonna use to hammer this home. It's like, you have to look at history. Like, not all the time is it applicable, but for teams that are kind of like generationally great, like this Kansas City Chiefs team is under the Pat Mahomes and Andy Reid era, right? You look at the last 5 years alone and what this Chiefs team has done under both of those guys. Stretch run, the last month of the season, the Chiefs going back to 19 were 4-0, then 3-1, 3-1, 4-0 in 2022, 3-1 last year. And I'm looking at this team this year, the way that the Chiefs are playing and winning games, and I'm looking at the Texans. You know, they played the Lions close, and they've played in a lot of close games, and they've fallen short in some games that you, against opponents you feel like they absolutely should have just kicked into teeth. But if this team is taking on a D'Amico Ryans personality and accepts this new role, and it's us versus the world, I feel like the Texans are as primed to beat the Chiefs at this point of the season as maybe they ever had been before. And what that could mean this time to the Texans is different than what it could have meant ever before.
Well, and just for those of you who haven't kept up with the division standings and whatnot, the Texans' magic number, to use the baseball phrasing, is 2. If they win 2 games, they're definitely in the playoffs and they win the division.
Mm-hmm.
They have a tiebreaker over the Colts. So if the Texans win 1 game and the Colts lose 1 game, and the Colts play the Broncos this week in Denver, where finally they're underdogs. For a long time, the advanced line has had the Colts as favorites going into Denver, and I did not get it or understand it at all. Now they're 3 or 4 point underdogs out in Denver. But then the Colts have 3 easy games. I shouldn't say easy, but they face the Titans, they have the Jaguars, and they have the Giants, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which order, but they've got 3 very winnable games after that. But realistically, you just have to win 1 game. So the Texans, if they don't win 1 of these next 3 games, I'm not even going to care about the playoffs. I'm just going to say, all right, well, I'd almost, if they can't win one of these next three games versus the Dolphins, the Chiefs, and then the Ravens,
yeah,
I'm going to feel like, all right, well, then I almost don't care if they're in, I almost don't want them in the playoffs because clearly they're not that team. Obviously they're not going to be favorites in the Chiefs in the Ravens game, but winning one of these next three games versus respectable opponents, you've got to do one of those if you're a genuine bona fide playoff team.
I get what you're saying, but as with anything else, the context is important. I mean, if the Texans are in an absolute knockdown, drag-out type game here in a couple of weekends against the Kansas City Chiefs, and they lose, let's just say, to the Chiefs on a Harrison Butker 31-yard field goal doinker off the left upright, like the Chargers did last night, I'd feel at least encouraged, even after a loss to the Chiefs, that, you know what, you get into the postseason, like, all chips are on the table. Like, if they could beat us in the regular season like that, then, damn it, with Kyahmi Fairbairn, who could boot a 59-yarder and against anybody, I'd feel just as good about the Texans' chances in upsetting somebody like that in the postseason. Because context is important. It's one thing if you're just, if you're getting beat like the Ravens beat the Texans last year in the divisional round, like, that's just a flat-out better team, okay?
Yeah.
They beat you, but, you know, off of some doinkers or a late-inning, you know, drive, if it's Pat Mahomes, if it's Lamar Jackson, like, those guys are great quarterbacks for a reason, and if they beat you like that, then you kind of tip your cap and move on, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess the difference is, and this is the dangerous part, is that you can get into any situation and say, well, hey, look, it was they had a one-score game against the Lions. They had a one-score game against the Packers. But it happens over and over and over again. And by the way, you lost to the Jets. You lost to the Titans.
you did in a very
embarrassing and second-half dismantling type of fashion that – I think that's who they are. You can't talk about the what have been, you know, what might have beens when you're consistently doing it over and over again. And that's where I need at some point over these next four games to see that they are a different team now. That they're one of these teams that can make a push and have figured some things out and can surge at the end of the season to feel like you're not going to have a replay of that Ravens game from last year.
Look, I think you and Sean are probably going to be able to have a really good discussion on this matter this week when Pendergast comes back tomorrow. But I am interested in a tweet that you had last Friday where you asked the question, the Texans are 2 years behind Detroit in terms of when the head coach was hired. What do they need to do in the next 2 years to get on the Lions level? That's a really in-depth, I think, fascinating conversation to have. But I'm going to ask you point blank, like, what can the Texans do over the course of the next couple of months to do what has been so intriguing about the Lions and what they've done the last 2 years, where they've been able to not just have a seat at the table with some of these marquee opponents like the Chiefs or the Ravens or the Niners, whoever it is in the NFL, and not just be competitive, but to beat their ass and to do so with some, you know, big time stones like Dan Campbell has and his team's taking on, you know, that kind of personality. Can the Texans accomplish some iteration of that over the course of the next month plus?
That's, so we'll do that next.
That's right? The question. 713-572-4610 if you'd like to weigh in. 572-4610. You can hit us up on the 5-Hour Energy fan line. What you think. We'll get to that and what the latest deals in baseball over the course of the last 24 hours means to the Houston Astros and the Alex Bregman situation. Stay there.
It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, here's Payne and Pendergast.
In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne this morning. Got you till 8 o'clock before we turn things over to Texans Radio. Make sure you keep it here on Sports Radio 610 all day, 10 until 2. The guys in the loop will be back in house today. Reggie Adetula, John Lopez, looking forward to that. Between now and then, Seth, I ask you the question, and I know you guys will have this discussion at some point this week between you and Sean Pendergast, but you know, how far behind the Lions are the Texans? That was a question you asked after the show on Friday. And just, I'm kind of curious if you think the Texans can at least tap into some of that over the course of the next, month plus and make a run.
I think the biggest thing is, and I realized after I'd asked that, okay, I could have just asked all right, what do the Texans have to do to beat the Lions when they intercept Jared Goff five times? Because that's probably the sum total of everything. The Texans defense is, it's not a record-breaking defense or anything else like that. It's certainly capable, though, of being, you could take that defense and plop it down on multiple other teams in the league and say, oh yeah, you could win a Super Bowl with that defense. The offense is decidedly not that same thing. So really, okay, how do you win a game with where you intercept the quarterback five times? How do you win two games this season where you're plus three in the turnover margin? When you look at the Lions, I think quarterback, I'm just 100% fine with C.J. Stroud. I feel better about his next 10 years over Jared Goff's next 10 years. It's hard not to just dial in on the offensive line. And then it's also hard not to notice, man, the Lions have not just one but two running backs that you get really nervous about. And then the way that the offensive coordinator ties it all together, I think those are the areas right now that are the most glaringly obvious. Okay, the offensive coordinator, the offensive line, and then the depth at running back is just night and day different than where the Texans are right now.
Yeah, boy, you're talking about offense tying everything together, and particularly Ben Johnson, the offensive coordinator. You could ask a very similar question, like, how far behind Bobby Slowick? How far behind is Bobby Slowick from Ben Johnson in his offensive innovation and what he's gotten his guys, you know, the ability to do with some terrific skill players in Detroit, like the Texans have now acquired here in Houston, some terrific skill players. Maybe not, we'll never see the full iteration of what Bobby Slowick thought he was going to have at his disposal, but he got some pretty good weapons still here.
He has the weaponry. Like, that's why there was so much optimism around the league. It wasn't just Houston bias or anything about what this Texans offense could do. And for the most part, the relatively impartial observers of quarterback play are still very impressed with the stuff that C.J. Stroud is able to do under imperfect circumstances. I think the tale with Brian Johnson can't be told without remembering that, oh yeah, he was a mid-season change in 2021. That the turnaround for the Lions really started when they demoted the play caller and made Brian Johnson the play caller, and then in the offseason going into 2022, he was named the offensive coordinator. That's what we were looking at earlier in the season as, hey, maybe there's a guy on staff that they feel as good about as Brian Johnson. And I mean, I was still, right up until all the Azeez Alshire hubbub, that was my biggest question going into the bye week was, okay, is there anybody on staff right now that they feel really good about? And would D'Amico actually pull the trigger at this point in the season when it's really your last chance? And all of that kind of fell by the wayside, partly because of the Azeez Alshire stuff, partly because the Texans scored two second half touchdowns versus one of the worst defenses in the league. But then also, I think it was also a matter of Nick Caserio just adamantly the other day saying flat out, no, there will be no change, or that they have faith in Bobby Slowick and they're not making a change. It felt like he slammed the door shut on any speculation.
Real quick, because I do want to get to some baseball stuff here, but I'm always intrigued by, making changes as offensive coordinator or play caller at this stage of the season. And we know teams do it, right? And we know there's been success, you know, for teams that have done it. But
the Bills last year.
Yes, absolutely. But my question is always, okay, if you're going to make a change, that means the person that you're going to turn the reins over to that's in-house has different ideas, has better ideas, has things, you know, up their sleeve that, you know, you believe in that we should have been getting to as a football team. That's why you make a change, right? And that for whoever's in charge right now, in case of Bobby Slowick, just has been unwilling or not confident enough to do that. Well, when you don't make a change, does that signal, like, you know, that, hey, maybe Gerard Johnson or Bill Lazor or whoever, like, they're all simpatico. Like, nobody really has any original ideas, or nobody else can really do anything that, is going to get the best out of this group or optimize this group like Bobby Slowick could.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Lazor's the guy on staff who has previous offensive coordinating experience, and none of it has been such of the variety that you know for sure, okay, like this is a guy that can just, it's not like you've got a late stage Norv Turner or something where you know he can come in and do something. Mm-hmm. It's not as much of a slam dunk. He was always in Lazor's when he's had his chances. It's been in imperfect circumstances in Cincinnati or in Miami. But I think there's, and then I think with Jerod Johnson, a couple of listeners brought this up when we first started discussing Jerod Johnson. I think there's a hesitancy to take a guy who hasn't been an NFL assistant coach that long and who hasn't been a coordinator before to replace a guy that you're realizing he was also a first-time offensive coordinator. So you're going to go through the same growing pains. Ben Johnson had been like a non-quality control guy, like full-time assistant coach since 2013, I think. So like he's got a couple of years a head start on Bobby Slowick. So I get that part of it. I think, like, in some regards, it's almost like the... I don't want to bring this team up, but, you know, the Giants and the bump that they got that first year with Brian Daboll.
Yeah.
It was almost too much of a turnaround too soon, and it maybe obfuscated just how real all of the other challenges were. Mm-hmm. And you end up like being ramped up on your rebuild process faster than the public perception was that you were going to be. I think that, and I'm going to have to be okay with this, I think that Caserio and D'Amico probably look at it as, hey, you've got a young coordinator, these are the growing pains you're going to have, but we believe in him moving on into the future. It's just the fan base and myself are not going to buy into that until we actually see evidence of it on the field.
Well, you talk about buying into things. To get to this here, just the last few minutes of today's show, the Mets have bought into a lot of Juan Soto. They give him the richest deal in pro sports history last night. 15-year pact, $765 million. Could be worth up to $800 million with escalators, no deferred money, according to reports. All that stuff. That's the biggest domino that possibly could have fallen, Seth. And I bring that up because prior to that, in fact, I think it was a day or two before, might have just been after we got off the show on Friday, but Willie Adames signed a deal with the San Francisco Giants. 7 years, $182 million. That's the biggest contract in Giants history. Bigger than Buster Posey's. But that's a big deal because reportedly that was one of the guys that maybe the Astros were looking at and that the Yankees were looking at. If, in fact, from the Astros' perspective, Alex Bregman was going to be deemed unsignable because of what he wants, that's a big deal. If the Astros are not willing to go, you know, 6+ years on Alex Bregman, probably not in the conversation really with Willie Adames. But the point is contingencies and plan Bs for the Astros are running short if, in fact, they don't make a decision on Alex Bregman. I think just by what we've learned over the course of the last 24, 48 hours, there's probably a decision or some finality, let's just say this, with Bregman at least, over the course of the next week, week and a half, that we should be looking out for.
The next week, you think?
I think so. I really do.
I've come to just be skeptical of any kind of like actual hot stove action in Major League Baseball free agency anymore.
Well, the reason why I say that is, look, you got the big domino that fell last night with Juan Soto. Now the attention turns, like, everybody's worried about, okay, is this guy going to get going to be a $600 million player? Hell, he's almost an $800 million player now. Attention now turns to your, you know, tier two guys, let's so to speak. If Juan Soto was sitting by itself in tier one, now you look at, you know, your Alex Bregman types and what kind of deals are they going to be commanding and how much did the overall market change with his contract and if it has anything to do with, if one has anything to do with the other, I think players and teams really kind of want to have some finality before Christmas, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't know. I also know Bregman's personality, and I feel like he's just so calm. I don't think there's any part of Bregman that's like agitating or calling Scott Boras and
saying,
"You gotta get this deal done now, damn it." He's just off in the batting cage somewhere with his son, just working on stuff, and Boras will Boris will handle it whenever he handles it. I guess the one thing about Adama is that if you want to look on the optimistic side of it, is it's the average per year is about the same. It's just one extra year. We know that's the big part that the Astros get hung up on, and we might never. They're not going to stretch that far.
Yeah. Hey, man, a lot of fun this morning. We'll talk to you again soon. Pendergast will be back tomorrow. Make sure you keep it locked in here. Coming up next, it's Texans Radio on Sports Radio 610.